And welcome back. Before we continue with our discussion about civil disobedience versus the rule of law, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Governor Jay Nixon has lifted his state of emergency designation he issued 3.5 weeks ago to control the situation in Ferguson in the aftermath of the shooting of Michael Brown. Nixon says things have returned to normal in the St. Louis suburb. More than 24 local groups are announcing at this hour the formation of a new coalition of local leaders and organizations and their first public demand for action in response to Brown's death. They have gathered outside the offices of St. Louis County Prosecutor Bob McCullough. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU, and throughout the day on stlpublicradio.org. Civil disobedience is a likely next step among those protesting the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson. There's continued talk of blocking highway traffic in protest. There was a small, short-lived stoppage over the weekend. Civil disobedience as a tactic in civil rights cases is nothing new. Martin Luther King used it effectively in the 60s. So did St. Louis activist Percy Green. He made civil disobedience an art form in focusing on inclusion and employment. He took on McDonnell Douglas, a case that went to the Supreme Court. He caused well-publicized disruptions in Gateway Arch construction and at the Veiled Prophet Ball. 97-year-old St. Louis attorney and civil rights activist Frankie Freeman worked tirelessly to help integrate public housing here. She spent 16 years on the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. She turned to the law to end discrimination. As part of our St. Louis History in Black and White project, the two discussed these respective tactics on this program in 2009. Percy Green began by saying the law moved too slowly to suit him.
Yes, which is why civil disobedience come into being. You know, some people feel as if that let's go, you know, theoretically they feel let's go by electoral type politics. Let's just vote people out that are not doing their job and so on and so forth. But, you know, that's 4 years and sometimes 6 years difference or whatnot. So what do you do in between? So I think that basically some of us are impatient with the politicians and also going through the legal means, the courts. And so, therefore, a more expedited approach was that of civil disobedience. That's why I'm saying that I'm a disciple of the civil disobedience. And that is pretty much what King was about. Now, in so doing, it's no guarantee that you're going to get things that you're demanding that are going to take place. But the only thing is that it becomes a strategy whereby you carry on the civil disobedience, and when you are arousing the consciousness of the establishment, you're doing the same thing for politicians as well. Sometimes politicians use the various issues that those of us that engage in civil disobedience cause, and then they become... politicians use those various issues to run on, and sometimes they get elected, sometimes not. But nonetheless, many of us think that it's good to have people that are conscious in various positions, you know, in agencies and in political positions to move the ball. But a lot of time they will not do it unless you develop a crisis. Civil disobedience many times causes the crisis that is necessary for people to engage.
It takes a partnership, not necessarily a partnership personally, but it takes a partnership of action. Some of the things that Percy Green did brought to the attention of many people who would never have even recognized the fact that even during that same time, the rule of law was being prevailed by the cases that were in the courts. Percy Green has a case that was in 1973 in which he had filed suit against McDonnell Douglas. I was on the Civil Rights Commission. We were studying employment discrimination. In 1970, the Civil Rights Commission held hearings in St. Louis in which we were concerned about employment by government contractors. When we subpoenaed the McDonnell Douglas, the testimony was that the government, the Air Force, had given McDonnell Douglas a contract without an affirmative action plan. The Civil Rights Commission questioned that. They put that the contract under suspension until 10 days later. McDonnell Douglas came up with an affirmative action plan, which was the basis for which he was able to win his case in 1973.
Green calls his successful suit, which went all the way to the Supreme Court, his most significant achievement.
I would like to think so, and because it, you know, it did the greatest good for the largest number of people, because prior to the Green versus McDonnell case, to my knowledge, you could not prove racial discrimination or any other kind of discrimination unless the person who perpetrated the ill admitted to it. Mm-hmm. So the Green versus McDonnell case brought about the possibility of circumstantial evidence as a way of, at least that's my understanding, you know. So it seems like to me, and from what I've been hearing, and that it's one of the most cited cases related to these matters.
Activists like Freeman and Green are well aware of the fact that actions like theirs have their consequences.
Because we caused the suspension of that contract for the 10 days, I at that time was Associate General Counsel of the St. Louis Housing Authority. And I was still as a commissioner, but I took time out for that hearing. But when I got to the Housing Authority, I received a notice that my services as a Housing Authority attorney were terminated as of 5:30 that day. But when they, 10 days later, and so I went back to private practice. Mm-hmm. But after McDonnell Douglas got its act together, they did at least improve. There were several areas of discrimination that continued. However, now, which is now Boeing, there are people who have been promoted to positions that never would have happened but for at least the actions of, say, both the Civil Rights Commission working under the rule of law and the action of Percy Green.
For Green, it was one of those consequences that led to the McDonnell Douglas suit in the first place. He'd been jailed many times over the years for his many demonstrations. But during the 60s, when he climbed the St. Louis Arch while it was under construction to protest discrimination in employment, his employer, McDonnell Douglas, worried that the publicity of his action reflected badly on the aerospace giant. Freeman, at the time, had other worries.
Well, I was hoping he'd get in right. When I heard about it, he was about few feet up, and I just hope he wouldn't fall and hurt himself.
Well, I lost my job. As a matter of fact, that's how the Green versus McDonald case came into being. I was working at McDonnell Douglas, and then 30 days after demonstration, climbing the arch, that is, mm-hmm. I was terminated.
Green lost his job, but won his case before the Supreme Court. His activism continued and included disrupting a St. Louis tradition, the Veiled Prophet Organization's annual ball. Blacks saw the all-white organization as elitist and symbolic of widespread discrimination in local employment. So Green engineered a risky infiltration involving the annual social event. White colleagues unmasked the Veiled Prophet himself. The prophet, who is elected annually and never publicly identified, was dressed in a costume not unlike the Ku Klux Klan and is an ongoing symbol of the organization. The white community was repelled. Younger St. Louisans were not.
Many of the young people they were inspired as a result of that type of activity. And from some of the communication that I got from some of them, they were just turned on about the civil disobedience by the mere fact it was clever about how we were able to get in. Of course, I mean, there were white members that was the one that was able to do that.
That should be pointed out. There was some help from whites along the way. You mentioned Charlie Oldham a little while.
It was a lot of whites that was involved in this particular episode. And then in my organization, it was always integrated. We always had whites in our organization. And so, therefore, that was the only way that we would have been able to pull this demonstration off. You know.
Freeman's reputation extends far beyond St. Louis, but she believes her finest achievement came here.
Well, I think I would probably, if I was going to identify one of the cases, it would be the case that ended segregation in public housing. However, I also am honored to have had the opportunity to serve as a commissioner of the U.S. Commissioner on Civil Rights and also under the Carter administration as the first Inspector General of the Community Services Administration. But to say, I believe that probably the case that ended segregation in public housing.
Freeman and Green can argue respectfully over their respective approaches to chipping away at discrimination, but for them, the bottom line is results.
The most important thing is the enlightenment, the education, the bringing the issues to people where at some point in time, people are engaged in these particular issues. And they don't happen a lot of times out of osmosis. A lot of times something or something has to happen. And I think that I happen to have been blessed to be around some people that were willing to run those kind of risks at the time. If Mr. Freeman filed suit on some of these bad actors or whatnot, then that brings some light to a certain situation. But you see, sometimes that doesn't happen, and then sometimes we have to act. We have to engage in some other kinds of civil disobedience in order to dramatize.
I think it's important to recognize that even those people have to have at least protection of the law. And so, therefore...
Sure. Oh, no, you're absolutely right. I'm not going to throw the law out now. I mean, I'm just saying, I'm not demeaning the law. Yeah, I'm just saying that it moves too slow, one thing. And then the other part of it, I mean, it depends upon situations and circumstances as to whether or not it's ever going to be enforced. It's a lot of wrongdoings going on out here, especially here in St. Louis and whatnot. And a lot of times... nobody says anything until a crisis situation occurs.
For these two, the past is important, but both recognize that the future may be more so.
For the children of St. Louis, that we do have major problems. We need to look to the community. We need to look to the parents. We need to look to the teachers. We need to look to the entire community working together to say, you need an education. You need to do your homework. You need to study. And those are the issues that we don't depend on a president to do. We need to depend on ourselves.
The conversation came after the inauguration of Barack Obama. For these two civil rights activists, Inauguration Day was very special.
What I remembered most was the first hearing of the Civil Rights Commission that we held in Mississippi in February of 1965, when following the murders of Jackson, Swimmer, and Goodman, and following all of the incidents that had occurred, the burnings of churches, in which we heard the testimony of witnesses, and we had in two counties in Mississippi, there was not one black person registered to vote. That was in 1965, and as I thought during these past months of how far we have come, in spite of all the problems that we listened to, we made recommendations included in the Voting Rights Act. And so when you ask me how I felt, all I can say is summarizing it by saying hallelujah.
I certainly I was elated to see what transpired with Obama being made president. The other things that went through my mind is that, okay, that's step one. Now the question is going to be as to whether or not the progressive whites and progressive blacks, whether they're going to push to allow for him to govern. See, it's one thing to be elected. The next thing, most important, is to be allowed to govern.
The struggle continues, and I think the majority of people know it. There are people who felt and who at least expressed on, say, Inauguration Day, when I said hallelujah, that did not mean that it's all over. That just meant that we can recognize that progress has been made, but we have to keep working.
Let's face it, you still have racial discrimination, gender discrimination, as well as discrimination as it relates to those that have other sexual preferences and so on and so forth. So I think that we still have a long ways to go. Some of the whites have been involved in the struggle for a long, long time. And for this coming together, this connection, I mean, that made it happen, So I really think that hats off to the progressive and the fair-minded whites in this country that was able to look beyond the skin color and elected Obama based upon his intellect and his wisdom.
Over the years, there have been many cases.
Right.
Many cases. I've been practicing law for 60 years. And during the early years of my practice, beginning the civil rights cases started in 1949. Mm-hmm. There are many lawyers. Thurgood Marshall and people in St. Louis know Robert Witherspoon and many of them. The struggle continues. The rule of law must prevail. The rule of law has made a significant contribution, but there have been other contributions that have been made, such as the kind of acts that Percy is talking about. Nobody is saying that that doesn't matter. All of it matters.
You've been listening to Frankie Freeman and Percy Green, civil rights activists. You can hear more oral histories and discussion on race relations and civil rights in our region by going to the St. Louis History in Black and White link on our website at stlpublicradio.org. There's music in the air in Ferguson. More on that when we come back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.